Essential issue that we're looking at relative to this book of 1 Corinthians is to sort of place ourselves in the pattern of what God is really after, what he wants. Doesn't make any difference what I think about anything. What is important is, what is God really saying? What would the Lord say if he were sitting here in my place? I think a lot of sermonizing is just sermonizing, you know, or have to get a nice lecture together for the next day or something. And you can do a lot of clever things with texts, you know, and you can make a lot of nice little 3-point and 5-point and acrostics and things like that. And it's delightful. But I'm not sure it's what Jesus would do if he were here. I'm not, or Paul or someone like that would. I'm not sure that's the way they would handle it. Nor would they ever use gimmicks, nor would they ever use leverage stuff. They would not use the text to, I think, beat people with. It's a very serious responsibility to me to see that what you're getting is essentially what Paul intended to say here in Corinthians, and essentially what the Spirit intended him to say. One of the major thrusts of this passage, perhaps the whole book of 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians, is the assessing of the humanness of the body of Christ, the people of Christ, and the antidote to that. That is, what does God think of their humanness, after all, see? So here we are tonight, human beings like the people in Corinth. I can imagine very readily a group of people just like this sitting in a home in Corinth. The home was that they met in was by the synagogue. Jason, I think, was the one in whose home they met. And he lived near the synagogue there in Corinth. And they met like we're meeting and talked about the things of Christ. They did not have a Bible spread out on their lap because they didn't have one. But Paul was a spokesman who was essentially the resource from God to communicate the revealed truth. Now, the apostles were resource people. That is to say, they are the ones through whom the original message was given that Christ wanted to express or extend to the world. That is why their ministry was often accompanied by various signs and wonders, or miracles, as we would call them. Because apart from that, they would not have had any authenticity or any authorization for their work. Tonight, you do not need authorization beyond the fact that I am here with the Word of God and with some degree of knowledge about it. I do not need to work miracles to authenticate the ministry, actually, because what I do need to do is come through to you via the Spirit in some kind of reasonable fashion that you can say that reaches my spirit and I feel at peace about it. Here, the thing that would attest the ministry of anyone today, rather than the miracle, would be the fact that the Holy Spirit witnesses the word to the Spirit, you see, and you come and hear it, and it ministers to you, and it gives you peace, or it gives you understanding. You have the comfortable feeling that this is a reasonable expression of the truth of God. So now, looking at the church in Corinth, to which Paul wrote, we find a number of problems there. Dissensions, strife, favoritism, or divisions. These were problems that Paul had to deal with. That's really a great encouragement to me. I think as encouraging as anything that I have seen is the realization that through all the centuries of church history, you never came to a point where the body of believers were perfected. Now we're going on to the 18th verse. the word of the cross is to those who are perishing foolishness. But to us who are saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the understanding of the understanders I will bring to naught, of the people that have their act together. Where is wisdom? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? God has certainly made foolish the wisdom of the world, has he not? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not through wisdom know God, it suited God through the foolishness of preaching to save those who believe. Since the Jews ask for a sign and the Greeks seek wisdom, we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews on the one hand an offense, to the Gentiles foolishness, but to those who are called, both Jew and Greek, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Now, remember that we are dealing with a community, a society here that was the pretty much the epitome of both Roman and Greek culture. Corinth was, of course, was at that time a port city, a very important commercial center, very highly sophisticated. It was everything, I think, that our modern cities are today. I don't think our problems today are really that much different than they were then. You might have a difference if we were talking about a little Greek village somewhere. We were on the island of Mykonos, and it's a delightful little village. Whitewashed, the streets were squeaky clean. A lot of the streets in the residential areas were just narrow walkways, and no automobiles went on them. That's why they were so clean. Everything whitewashed, even the streets more or less whitewashed. So the mortar between the stones that were the street was white. You were almost like in a hospital walking down those streets. There were the streets that automobiles went on, but it, as a village, it was just a delightful little village. Now, their lifestyle might be quite different from Corinth. But the problems in Corinth would not be unlike the problems in Los Angeles today. So we're dealing with the same kind of thing. And the great contrast here between the simplicity of the message of Christ and the perverted and convoluted and exalted wisdom of the Greek world was very marked in Paul's message here. And it again gives comfort. I've studied this text for a great many years now. Both, yeah, I took my first Greek course in 1942. And I've been studying it very intensely since then, you know, in university and then teaching it and so forth. So I've spent some time in this book, and I want to say that the longer I study it, the more simple it becomes. I think it's a very good direction because it just seems to get simpler and simpler when you shave off all the complexities that come out of philosophical musings and get down to the nitty-gritty of just what the Bible is saying. And I'm confident that a great many so-called teachers of the Bible have not read the Bible itself much. They've read a lot of books about it, a lot of commentaries, but they haven't really gotten right down to the text, or they wouldn't make some of the absurd statements that they make. But the important point to me is this. If we really come to grips with what God is saying to us, it ought to be simple enough for the simplest of citizens of this world to grasp. Why should it be that Americans sitting in a more or less privileged position, as far, if we can call it that may be a questionable word, but privileged position, as far as universities are concerned, as far as training is concerned, as far as literacy is concerned. Why should we have something that the Aborigine can't have, no matter how spiritual he is? Why should there be anything of an advantage to living in Los Angeles, for example, or Sydney, or whatever? Why should there be any advantage? Why should one Christian have an advantage over another? Why should the people in Corinth have any great advantage over the people of Galatia, for example, which is a far simpler place? Why? They shouldn't. So I have a feeling that the voluminous presentations of doctrine and theology and the multitudinous books, millions and millions of books written on theology, are superfluous to the real understanding of what God wants. The reason we need training is that we're 2,000 years away from the revelation. See? One might say, well, why did it take you 40 years to say this? Well, because we're nearly 2,000 years away from the original writing, and it's in a different language. And if one is going to be a resource to say this is what the Bible is saying, it just has to be some technical help, you see, so that we can get back to the message. Of course, a lot of people say, well, the Lord gives me that revelation, I don't need to study. But the fact that there are so many diverse revelations indicates that maybe the Lord isn't speaking to everyone in that fashion, see. It should encourage you to know in the first place that you're very ordinary. And that's good. You're pretty much what society has been, the people have been on the earth for centuries, what the church has been for centuries. We're pretty much the same. So we're neither worse nor better. I've often said if you could be transported back to the original church, as many people have a concern to, you know, everyone wants to go back to what they marvelous Christians were in the first century, and I think they'd be very disappointed if they could be transported back. They could say, my goodness, they know better than we are. I think that's very encouraging. The second thing that's encouraging is that the message does not have to be all that complex. See, when you come to hear the Word and the fellowship week after week and year after year, you're not coming always to get something new. I don't have to prepare some brand new thing every week. I don't even have to wear a new suit every week. We wear three or four suits all year long. And if I were on the stage, I have to wear a different suit every night, you know. And each one more spectacular than the last to keep the law of diminishing returns from working there. No, but we don't have to do that. We don't have to give you something new. We have to give you something to eat, something to touch the spirit. And I said, as I said Sunday, it's bread. And people just don't get tired of bread, really. But if you had ice cream every day, you might say that, well, you know, we had ice cream yesterday and yesterday. Why have ice cream every day? You might get tired of it. You don't expect the cook to prepare some gourmet feast every meal, something new. What we're saying tonight are things that in one way or another we've kind of shared along through the years. It comes as food. We eat again and again and again. And we remind ourselves again and again that Christ came in simple ways to the heart, which is simple. The spirit is a simple thing. The brain is a very complex thing. Our brains can get into more mischief in 1 hour than we can ever bail out of in 1 year. Our thinking just gets, you know, twisted and turned. Everything. That's the brain. The spirit is something different. The spirit is that inner sense of that element of us in which Christ dwells. The psyche is the flesh. The mind is part of the psyche. And fortunately, the spirit is detached from that in the sense that the spirit does not have to follow like a roller coaster the ups and downs of the psyche, which may be emotionally very unsteady. The glorious thing I want to get across again and again to you is that the Spirit of Christ is a constancy within us. Day in and day out and day in and day out. In spite of the fluctuations of the emotions and the attitudes and the thinking and everything else, the Spirit runs true and straight through day after day. And we fluctuate because you have your days that you're up and the days that you're down. Now, some organizations, some groups, religious groups, if they don't feel something grand, assume that they're not very grand that day. They're not up, that there's something wrong, not realizing that it's just the typical mental roller coaster of the psyche, and the Spirit of Christ does not have to depend on that. Christ does not hop aboard the roller coaster of our fickle brain, and neither does he run hurriedly out the back door when Satan comes along. He doesn't just abandon ship just because he sees the black flag of the enemy flying. But people would have you believe that, you know, that today Satan is in your throne and tomorrow Christ is and the next day Satan and so on and so forth. They're not playing King of the Mountain or musical chairs. The Spirit comes to stay within our spirits. But our minds fluctuate. Our feelings fluctuate. Now, that is said, you've heard that many times from me, but it is said in the interest of this matter of simplicity. The wisdom of God is so simple that it is beyond the complexities of the human morass of our brain. The less you know about a thing, the more complicated you make it, you see. And as I've said, true to form, the ultimate or the most essential knowledge of the universe pulls us back to simplicity again, to one unit. The whole universe is one unit, an atom, with its components, you see. But it's one thing. We're all made of one thing. The floor is made of the same thing that our heads are made of. And the walls made the same thing as your big toe, you see. These are all atoms. They're in different arrangements, different relationships. But that is so like God that everything should be simple. And now we come to the issues of electromagnetism, where, I mean, in today's developments, you can power an entire city off of one little unit the size of your finger or fingernail. It isn't available at the present, but it's there. It's experimented with. Our electronic equipment, for example, the wireless, you see, the use today of telephones with no wires anywhere. Computers, which once occupied an entire building, now can sit on the desktop. Everything is drawn to simplicity. Now, if we're on course in the study of the Word, the more we know, the more we're going to be reduced to simplicity. That is so like God. We were talking about the kingdom last Sunday. And when you really get into the essence of it, you find it simplified so much. Such a simple thing. Whereas if you don't know much about it, you can write a 1,000-page book on it. Like some speaker, I don't remember, I think it was one of the great speakers, maybe Oliver Wendell Holmes or somebody. Anyway, someone asked him to give a speech and asked him how long it would take him to prepare. And he said, well, how long do I have to speak? He said, if I have an hour to speak, I'm ready right now. If I have 5 minutes, it'll take me a while to prepare it. Now, going on with this, he says, the word of the cross is to those who perish foolishness. Now, it's in their sense, a sort of insanity. The word used here is the word basis of our word moron, moria. The word foolishness in our parlance, in English, or in Americanese at least, the word foolish means something silly. And your mother says to the child, now don't be foolish. She means, you know, quit acting like a ninny, quit being silly. So this word means something tantamount to vacuous, empty-headed. So here were these Greeks with all these great philosophical writings, starting, for example, with Socrates. Socrates was the teacher of Plato. Plato was the teacher of Aristotle. Now, to get yourself into the time frame, Aristotle, on the other hand, was a teacher of Alexander the Great, who lived around 350 B.C. Now, by Paul's time, which was 400 years later, you see, Greek philosophy had been developed to an extremely intense degree. And you had thousands of pages of writing. If you've ever tried to work through the works of Plato, for example, you've got a job on your hands. So Plato wrote just voluminously about things that today are totally inane, have very little relevance to anything. And Socrates, the same, and Aristotle and these fellows. In the early days of universities in Europe, and around the 12th, 13th centuries, the whole essence of the university curriculum was Aristotle. These were universities of Aristotle, and his teachings were in vogue, and he was the one, he taught about all kinds of things. He rambled on about the five senses and the planets and all these kinds of things. But today, you know, if you would advertise, we're going to have a university, it's going to be built around the works of Aristotle. Who would come? If you made it free, somebody might come. You know, it's inane. Nobody even thinks about it or cares a rap about it. People study the works of Plato less and less, but they care very little about it. Now, you can get a doctor's degree in philosophy. You can spend 10 years studying philosophy on a highly disciplined level and come out with a doctor's degree in it. And when you're through, all you have is a mastery of the inconsequential. Because what does anybody really care what any of these people said? You know, even if you are very articulate about Kant or Schleiermacher or any of these philosophers, you may know all about them. You might wow somebody with your knowledge, but nobody cares. Who cares what Kant said? So it's a very excessive discipline about a very minuscule concept, you see, and we don't really care. I'm saying that for this reason. Came the Greeks to the early Christians and said, you know, what are you doing here, you morons? I mean, this, you're talking to me about a cross, about Jesus, all these things. They thought Paul had new gods. The resurrection was a god he was talking about. And, you know, they looked at these Christian people and said, what you're telling me is foolishness. In fact, they called Paul a seed picker. In the King James, it's translated babbler, but the Greek word means a seed picker, you know, like a cotton picker. You say, almost say, what's that cotton picker going to say to us today? Because they thought he was just like their philosopher who sat in the agora and rambled on about nothing. This was the view of these people. But today, all that the Greeks taught would be regarded as pretty peripheral. Even the most highly respected, Socrates, Plato, and others, knowledge has gone so far beyond whatever they talked about that it's a nice thing for antiquities. You know, if you want to study the antiquities, you can study Plato. If you want to do something worthwhile or practical, you study electronics or something like that. But, you know, nobody really cares about Plato. Again, on the other hand, so you have many universities in the world that were basically given to that study. And many of our modern universities today started with that. Even here in America, USC, for example, seems to be a very secularistic institution, but they were started by the Methodists, Princeton by the Presbyterians, and so on and so on. So, well, I guess all the universities in America were started by a Christian group of one kind or another. But today, if you have a lecture on the subject of Christ, let's take that raw subject. We're going to talk about Christ or whatever way you want to talk about him. You can get quite a group of people together over that. If you announce a lecture on Plato, you're not going to have much of a problem with too many people in the room. Nobody talks about it. So the Greeks have said, what are you doing with this Christ and this cross and so forth? It's all foolishness. Today, their stuff is foolishness. In your own pursuit of life, it seems often just too simple for our modern civilization to stay close to Christ and what He wants in your life. That seems a little too simple for our modern civilization. But I would say that the essence of wisdom is simplification. Simplify your lives. Pull things into a simpler focus, and you'll be moving in a sound direction. That is, if you have to make choices, choose between the simpler versus the more complex, and you'll be likely moving in a better direction. I've used this analogy before, but I'm going to give it again. It's apropos here. You can think of a bell curve. It's shaped like a bell. That's why they call it a bell curve. Think of this bell curve with me for a moment. And you have the condition of the teenager, for example. They start with zero. Now they're going to build a career. So you have this intense rise. Let's take the very dynamic, enterprising young person. And they give a life to building this career. You see, they go into business or they go into professions. And they struggle and strive, and they probably sacrifice many things getting there if they're really, I mean, if their focus is strictly this worldly. Now you come to the top of the bell curve. You're 45 or you're 50 or 55. And you've reached the zenith of your career. And you may be the most highly trained specialist in your field in the world at this point, or one of the most highly trained. A few years more, you're down the other side. And it isn't many more years till you're right back at the bottom and somebody is carting you around. And if you've acquired a palatial home, the kids have it now, and you're in a rest home, right? Euphemistically called a rest home. Retirement community, which means nothingsville. But anyway, you're back down to zero before you started, right? You started as a teenager with zero. You went through all of this struggling and striving, and now you're back down to zero again. You find them in a rest home somewhere, and they have this Alzheimer's disease, which is a tragic thing where they can hardly recognize anybody, premature senility. We're talking about simplicity, about pulling life down to its simplest denominators. And that's comforting to you. Because you may look at your own life and you say, well, I'm not really very much. I mean, I'm just doing this more or less mediocre kind of job, or I'm a housewife, or I'm a gardener, or whatever. You think, you know, I'm a very simple person. And I'm saying to you, that's probably closer to the essence of reality than the career person who has, in the meanwhile, sacrificed everything for that career. Now, understand, I'm not saying you shouldn't go to college, or I'm not saying there's anything wrong with a career or a profession, but only if that's what the Spirit of Christ has led you into, because then you'll be a useful tool, you see. If you're there because Christ put you there, you'll still be there for the simplest of reasons, and you'll still function in your career for the simplest goals, and you'll be success at it, you see. And you won't sacrifice everything on the altar of your service if you are there in the name of Christ, and you've kept your life in balance. The only essential reality of life is then, what is it that Christ is doing with us? What is our life in relation to Christ? And don't worry about all the complex possibilities around you. These poor ladies will read the magazines and they watch television and they think their life is so nothing because of these glorious career ladies and all these things. And they, and, you know, and it's really tragic because these are the most unfulfilled people in the world, these great career women. I was reading an article not long ago of the increasing percentage of executives among women who felt they really, that life had passed them by. Because in the meantime, they sacrificed significant human relationships. Now at the age of 35 or 40 with their career in full bloom, they can't find a husband that they can live with. They have no children often, or the children have slipped out from them because they haven't been able to give them the attention. And now they're becoming unfulfilled again. This poor little lady at the sink watching her television set is saying to herself, oh, I wish I could be fulfilled like that woman. You know. I remember, I'm going to conclude with this. It's kind of analogous, rather earthy, but I was in a certain city where I have a Bible class, and I was in a stationery store there. And this woman came in who was just very smartly dressed, and she drove a very nice automobile, and she was sharply attired, made up and everything else, and so charming. Of course, I've met the kind over and over again. I wasn't very much fooled. But anyway, she's at the front cash register, and she's just oozing charm and goodwill and everything else. But I happen to know that she was also running for a political office in the town. But anyway, she swept out the door and got into her handsome sedan, and off she went. And the girl at the cash register was a very nice young lady, but rather simple, you know, very nice. And she said, oh, isn't she gorgeous? And I said, well, you could be gorgeous, too, if you were running for office, you know. you know, you could be so many things like that. But the person moving in a simple vein may look at that and say, boy, I just wish I could be fulfilled like that. But they don't know the emptiness of the whole thing. Paul is giving us here one of the most fundamental principles of life, and it is so like God. That is, simplicity is the issue here. And what may look too simple, too foolish, too empty to the world may be, in fact, the essence of all of life. We can be at peace. I don't know what the Lord has in the days ahead for your lives, each of you, or what suffering you may have, what misfortunes, what distresses, what successes, what advances, prosperities, or whatever. I don't know that. You don't know that. But I know the glorious truth that your present outlook on life, which focuses on Christ, if it didn't, you wouldn't be here, right? There's no reason to come. And this ministry, the person that wants the best of both worlds is really in trouble in this ministry. So you wouldn't be here. Some of you have been coming for many, many years. You wouldn't be here for that, except for that. So I know that's what your outlook is. And you might tend to look around you and say, well, you know, I wish things were a little brighter and so forth. And I say to you, this is reality. This is the essence of things. To follow Christ. We can't guarantee that everything we do every day is what He would like us to do. But our heart is to follow Christ. Our heart is to be pleasing to Him. Our heart is to get along with one another, to care about one another. We don't always get along, and that's good. Because I mean to say that's certainly natural, and it fits us right into the same slot that the Corinthians were. We should like to think we could be better, but I probably won't be. Anyway, it's so comforting to know that sitting here tonight, we are in really close touch with the essence of what God wants us to know in this world.